Contribute online at kpfk.org.
This is Gary Oldman. You're listening to radio powered by the people, KPFK 90.7 FM.
Hi, this is Jamie Cromwell. You are listening to 90.7 FM KPFK Los Angeles and 98.7 FM Santa Barbara.
Wednesday, May 14th. I'm Lauren Schmidt. Foreign ministers from BRICS nations gather in India amid growing division over the war in Iran. Israel threatens legal action against the New York Times over a column detailing allegations of sexual abuse. The head of U.S. Border Patrol resigns amid controversy. And lawyers for Elon Musk and OpenAI deliver closing remarks in a landmark trial. These stories and more coming up from the studios of KPFA in Berkeley. This is the Pacifica Evening News. I'm Lauren Schmidt. Tensions are escalating again near the Strait of Hormuz after a ship anchored off the United Arab Emirates was seized and taken towards Iran. Another was attacked and sank near the coast of Oman. The incidents reported today came as a senior Iranian official reiterated his country's claim to the waterway. Iranian Foreign Minister Abbas Agarchi blamed tensions in the Strait of Hormuz on what he called U.S. aggression. He spoke to reporters at the BRICS summit.
The Strait of Hormuz is now suffering first and most from the U.S. aggression and the blockade that they have imposed on it. As far as we are concerned, the Strait of Hormuz is open for all commercial vessels. They need to cooperate with our Navy. We have not made any obstacles. It is Americans who have made blockade, and I hope that that could be ended by the removal of this illegal blockade imposed by Americans.
He was joined alongside other foreign ministers from BRICS nations, which began a two-day meeting in New Delhi today. As the expanding bloc confronts divisions over the war in Iran, rising oil prices, and growing global economic uncertainty. The meeting brought together diplomats from Brazil, Russia, India, China, and South Africa. The talks come as the conflict involving Iran continues to disrupt global energy markets and drive up oil prices. The gathering also coincides with President Trump's visit to Beijing. India's Foreign Minister Subramanyam Jaishankar said discussions have focused on regional and global challenges, including energy costs, food prices, and economic cooperation.
We meet at a time of considerable flux in international relations, ongoing conflicts, economic uncertainties, and challenges in trade and technology and climate are shaping the global landscape. There is a growing expectation, particularly from emerging markets and developing countries, that BRICS will play a constructive and stabilizing role.
founded by Brazil, Russia, India, and China. BRICS was formed as a coalition of major emerging economies and is often viewed as a counterweight to Western-led institutions such as the G7. The bloc has increasingly sought a larger role in global affairs and has gained support across parts of the global south, where many countries have criticized Western-dominated financial and political institutions. Food security was already a global concern, even before the war in Iran led to the closure of the strait, choking off oil and fertilizer shipments. Leaders from across Europe and Central Asia gathered in Tajikistan Wednesday for a meeting of the Food and Agriculture Organization of the United Nations. Qi Dongyu is the director of the FAO.
The challenges we face, the climate crisis, economic pressure, and supply chain disruptions, among others, do not respect the borders. Our agri-food systems are integrated, and so must our solutions.
The strains on the food system, from climate to war's effect on agriculture, come at the same time that donor nations have slashed their donations for humanitarian aid. Farhan Ha is a spokesperson for the United Nations Secretary General.
WFP has reduced its emergency food assistance by 50%. On Syria, critical funding shortfalls are forcing the World Food Program to significantly scale back its operations in Syria. WFP has reduced its emergency food assistance by 50%, from 1.3 million people to 650,000 people in May, and halted a nationwide bread subsidy program that has supported millions daily. The bread subsidy program has been a vital lifeline.
While there are many issues to deal with, Qi Dongyu of the FAO puts one issue at the front.
Peace and stability are prerequisites for food security, and the right to food is a basic human right. We must work together to mitigate the impact of the conflict on vulnerable populations, ensure food, fertilizer, seeds reach those who need them most.
Global oil inventories are falling at a record pace as supply disruptions tied to the ongoing war continue to strain energy markets. That's according to a new report by the International Energy Agency. The Guardian reports that the agency found global oil stockpiles fell by 129 million barrels in March and another 117 million in April, as countries drew down reserves to offset shortages linked to disruptions in the Strait of Hormuz. The International Energy Agency says the losses come more than 10 weeks after the conflict in the Middle East began, warning that mounting supply disruptions are depleting global inventories at an unprecedented pace. Meanwhile, Reuters reports the Trump administration announced it will loan 53.3 million barrels of crude oil from the United States Strategic Petroleum Reserve as part of a broader international effort to stabilize global energy markets. The Energy Department says nine companies, including the American multinational oil and gas corporations ExxonMobil and Marathon Petroleum, as well as Singaporean-based Trifigura, who accepted portions of the emergency loans. The U.S. had already reportedly loaned roughly 80 million barrels from the reserve this spring and is seeking to release a total of 172 million barrels under an agreement reached with more than 30 countries through the International Energy Agency. IEA Executive Director Faith Barral has described the conflict in Iran as the largest energy crisis in modern history and warned additional strategic reserves could be released if disruptions continue. U.S. inflation climbed to 3.8% in April, the highest level in 3 years, as the ongoing war in the Middle East continues driving up energy and consumer prices. But Americans are not alone in facing mounting economic pressure. In Lebanon, the war and broader regional instability are deepening an already severe economic crisis, with businesses reporting layoffs, slowing sales, and rising prices for basic goods. Merchants and residents told international media outlets that higher fuel and import costs have worsened inflation and made everyday necessities increasingly unaffordable. Reporters with the Associated Press spoke with Beirut shop owner Ayman Al-Zain.
Everything is expensive. If I want to open a new store and get mannequins, hangers, and some accessories, the prices are very different than before. If I want to begin rebuilding my shop, it's expensive. If I want to get tiles, it's expensive. If I want to buy anything, it's expensive.
The war has sent economic shockwaves across the Middle East. In Lebanon, those pressures have been compounded by years of economic collapse and largely unregulated markets vulnerable to price gouging. In the usually crowded Sabra produce market south of Beirut, vendor Ahmad Al-Fada said prices surged after the U.S. and Israel launched strikes on Iran in late February, followed by renewed fighting between Israel and Hezbollah.
We're keeping our prices low so we can sell, and even then, we're not selling. Work has decreased by 30%. The area is not doing well. We weren't doing well before the war here, so imagine what it's like after.
Al-Fada spoke as the sound of an Israeli drone buzzed overhead. Mohammed Fayour, the associate professor of finance at the American University of Beirut, says Lebanon's economy was already operating in what he called a state of extreme fragility, even before the latest escalation.
Lebanon has been grappling with multiple rounds of crises, starting from a deep financial meltdown in 2019, followed by a port explosion, followed by an Israeli war on Lebanon in 2024, and now the second wave of Israeli war on Lebanon.
Since 2019, Lebanon's currency has lost more than 90% of its value against the U.S. dollar. Restaurant owner Riyad Aboutif says revenue at several of his Beirut businesses has also fallen by roughly 90% since the war began.
And the difference is huge between pre-war and during the war, because people are saving more of their money to their survival, because the mindset of the people is now, you know, we're not going for birthdays, we're not going for occasions.
Price gouging in Lebanon has become a growing concern, as Lebanese officials say the government has limited ability to regulate the small number of companies that control fuel and good imports. Economy Minister Amir Bassat said authorities have conducted more than 4,000 inspections, filing dozens of complaints in court related to price gouging. But officials acknowledge the problem is unlikely to be resolved quickly.
The bottom line is there is an inflationary shock that is inevitable. We live it, we're importing it, and we have to absorb it. I mean, there's no question about it. This continues to be a major economic shock, one of honestly an existential nature.
With no clear end to the conflict in sight, Lebanon's economic outlook continues to worsen. A fragile ceasefire remains in place between the United States and Iran. While fighting between Israel and Hezbollah has slowed, it is not fully stopped. Dropsite News reports that Israeli strikes continued across Lebanon Thursday, with its national news agency reporting at least two people killed in an airstrike on a residential building. Additional strikes and drone attacks were reported in southern Lebanon and in the Bekaa Valley, with several more wounded. Meanwhile, Hezbollah reportedly launched a drone strike near the Lebanese-Israeli border that injured three Israelis, one of which is in critical condition. Lebanese officials say Israeli attacks killed at least 15 people across the country Wednesday, including two children. Strikes were reported near schools and hospitals, while the Israeli military also issued new displacement warnings for several southern villages. UNICEF warned today that at least 59 children have been killed or injured in Lebanon over the past week alone. The agency says more than 770,000 Lebanese children are now at risk of long-term mental health impacts due to repeated exposure to violence and displacement. Since the Israeli attacks intensified in Lebanon, more than 1 million people have been displaced. Large numbers are now sheltering in schools or spending what savings they have left on temporary housing and hotel rooms. DropSite News is also reporting that the U.S.-led Board of Peace is preparing for what officials describe as a contingency or Plan B for Gaza reconstruction, after negotiations reportedly stalled. According to Axios, the proposal would begin implementing parts of President Trump's 20-point Gaza framework in areas currently under Israeli control. The reported plan would relocate a Palestinian technocratic government from Cairo into parts of Gaza controlled by Israel, launch reconstruction projects, deploy an international stabilization force, and train a new Palestinian police force in Egypt. Officials involved in the discussions reportedly acknowledge concerns the proposal could effectively create two Gazas. Meanwhile, a conflict monitoring group called the Armed Conflict Location and Event Data Project says Israel has escalated its attacks on Gaza by 35% in April compared to March. Gaza's health ministry says at least 120 Palestinians, including 8 women and 13 children, have been killed since April 8th, when the U.S.-Israeli war involving Iran paused. Palestinian officials say that since the so-called ceasefire began in October, at least 157 Palestinians have been killed in Gaza, and hundreds of bodies continue to be recovered from beneath the rubble. Israel says it plans to sue the New York Times over a recent opinion essay detailing allegations of sexual abuse against Palestinians held in Israeli custody. KPFA News would like to note that the following story contains allegations and descriptions of sexual violence and abuse that some listeners may find disturbing. Listener discretion is advised. The piece, titled "The Silence That Meets the Rape of Palestinians," was written by veteran New York Times columnist Nicholas Kristof and draws on reporting from United Nations investigators, international human rights groups, advocacy organizations, and testimony from Palestinian men, women, and children, alleging abuse by Israeli prison guards, soldiers, settlers, and interrogators. Kristof wrote that while there is no evidence Israeli leaders directly ordered rape, UN officials and human rights investigators have documented what they describe as patterns of sexual violence within Israel's detention system. A 2024 United Nations report described sexual violence as part of what investigators call Israel's, quote, standard operating procedures in the treatment of Palestinians, close quote. The article also cites findings from the Geneva-based EuroMed Human Rights Monitor, which alleges Israel has employed systematic sexual violence as part of an organized state policy. The report includes allegations of multiple forms of sexual assault, including accounts involving dogs. According to figures cited in the essay, more than 20,000 Palestinians have been detained in the occupied West Bank since the October 7th attacks, with more than 9,000 reportedly still being held. Many detainees, according to the rights groups, have not been formally charged and have been denied access to legal counsel. The international nonprofit Save the Children surveyed Palestinian youth between the ages of 12 and 17 who had experienced Israeli detention. More than half reported witnessing or experiencing sexual violence, though researchers said stigma likely contributed to underreporting. The Committee to Protect Journalists also surveyed 59 Palestinian journalists released from Israeli custody after October 7th. According to the organization, 3% reported being raped, while 29% reported other forms of sexual violence. The Guardian has separately published accounts alleging sexual abuse of Palestinians in Israeli custody, including reports that some Israeli soldiers and settlers used sexual assault and threats of violence to force Palestinians from their homes in the occupied West Bank. The Israeli Prison Service denied the allegations referenced in the New York Times essay and rejected claims of widespread sexual violence against Palestinian prisoners. Israel's foreign ministry, in a social media post today, described the article as, quote, one of the most hideous and distorted lies ever published against the state of Israel in the modern press, close quote. It said it would pursue legal action against the newspaper. Prior to Israel threatening legal action, Kristof publicly defended his reporting against accusations. He shared this post on social media.
Prime Minister Netanyahu has called accusations of sexual violence by Israelis baseless. But my reporting suggests that sexual violence has greatly worsened under Netanyahu in recent years.
Since the publication of the essay, Kristof says he has received threats of violence and death. The Council on American Islamic Relations, or CARE, condemned a former Biden administration anti-Semitism envoy, Deborah Lipstadt, for disputing reports of abuse in Israeli detention facilities and for resharing a social media post that CARE says implicitly called for violence against Kristof. The New York Times has not publicly responded to Israel's threat of a lawsuit, but the paper has continued defending Kristof's reporting in recent days. The controversy also comes amid broader scrutiny of Western media coverage of Israel's war in Gaza. Earlier this week, The Intercept published an analysis alleging systemic pro-Israel bias in mainstream media coverage. Last week, KPFA reported on the BBC's decision not to air the documentary Gaza, Doctors Under Attack, which was later acquired by Zatteo and went on to win a BAFTA. UN expert Francesca Albanese says a U.S. federal judge has temporarily blocked sanctions imposed against her by the Trump administration. The preliminary injunction suspends these sanctions while a legal challenge moves forward. The lawsuit argued the sanctions were retaliation for Albanese's calls for the International Criminal Court to investigate alleged war crimes involving Israeli and American nationals. In granting the injunction, the judge wrote that, quote, protecting the freedom of speech is always just the public interest, close quote. Albanese had previously described the sanctions as financially crippling, saying they prevented her from opening bank accounts, assessing insurance reimbursements, and traveling to the United States, where members of her immediate family are citizens. Following the ruling, Albanese posted on social media thanking her husband and daughter for defending her and wrote, quote, together we are one, close quote. Albanese serves as the United Nations Special Rapporteur on Human Rights in the Occupied Palestinian Territories, an independent position appointed by the UN Human Rights Council to investigate and publicly report on conditions in the region. In Ukraine, authorities say a massive Russian drone and missile attack has demolished an apartment block in Kyiv, killing nine and wounding dozens. It was a third straight day that Moscow has unleashed such a large-scale barrage. President Volodymyr Zelensky said Russia launched over 1,500 drones at Ukraine since Wednesday. The bombardment has affected multiple cities and strained Ukraine's air defenses. Damage to energy infrastructure has left many without power. Ukraine's foreign minister is calling for international pressure on Moscow and noted that the attacks come as U.S. President Donald Trump met in Beijing with Chinese leaders and said the two leaders had sufficient leverage to compel Russia to stop the war. This is the Pacifica Evening News here on KPFA. We'll be back to our broadcast in 30 seconds, but I want to remind you that we are in our spring membership drive. And if you value this journalism and the work we do every day here at KPFA, please become a member right now. You can call 800-439-5732. That's 800-HEY-KPFA or donate online at kpfa.org. Good news is Kathy in Sonoma has offered a $1,000 match after hearing we fell short yesterday. Your donation is what keeps this newsroom going and keeps these critical stories coming to you live every day on KPFA. We go back to the news. We'll update on the match at the end of the broadcast. President Donald Trump and China's President Xi Jinping held the first discussions of their high-profile summit in Beijing. Both leaders talked about the importance of U.S.-China relations, but they focused on different issues. And so far, there are no signs of a major breakthrough on any of them. KPFA's Christopher Martinez reports.
President Donald Trump and China's Xi Jinping held the first face-to-face meeting of their Beijing summit, with expectations that they would discuss issues from trade to Taiwan and the war in Iran. But speaking to reporters afterwards, Trump's account was a bit terse and tepid.
Great.
Did you talk about Taiwan?
Great place. Incredible. China's beautiful. Yeah.
Trump and Xi met behind closed doors for about 2 hours, but the American and Chinese accounts of the discussion don't exactly match. The White House says the leaders discussed economic cooperation. Trump is hoping to come back with deals for China to buy more American soybeans, beef, and aircraft. It also says they discussed fentanyl and that they agreed the Strait of Hormuz must remain open. U.S. Secretary of State Marco Rubio told Fox News Channel's Hannity that Trump will urge China to take a more active role on Iran.
Well, of all the countries of the world, economies are melting down because of this crisis in the Straits. They're going to be buying less Chinese product, and the Chinese exports are going to drop precipitously. So it's in their interest to resolve this. We hope to convince them to play a more active role in getting Iran to walk away from what they're doing now and trying to do now in the Persian Gulf.
China's account of the meeting emphasized the issue of Taiwan. According to a social media post by Chinese Foreign Ministry spokesperson Mao Ning, Xi told Trump that the Taiwan question is the most important issue in China-U.S. relations. It goes on to say, if it's handled properly, the bilateral relationship will enjoy overall stability. Otherwise, the two countries will have clashes and even conflicts, putting the entire relationship in great jeopardy. After the meeting, Xi took Trump on a tour of the Temple of Heaven, followed by a state banquet where Trump and Xi exchanged toasts, though with decidedly different tones. While both spoke of the importance of the China-U.S. relationship, Trump praised Xi as a friend and great leader. He also made a surprise announcement, inviting his counterpart to visit the United States.
Thank you again, President Xi, for this beautiful welcome, and tonight it is my honor to extend an invitation to you and Madam Peng to visit us at the White House this September 24th, and we look forward to it. And I'd now like to raise a glass and propose a toast to the rich and enduring ties between the American and Chinese people. It's a very special relationship.
Trump described a relationship between the two countries that dates back to America's founding.
And across the centuries, this mutual esteem grew into a relationship that reflected the tremendous talent and potential of our two people. Chinese workers helped lay the railroad tracks that connected our Atlantic coast to the Pacific. American travelers to China helped spread literacy and modern medicine, and at the request of China's ambassador, it was President Theodore Roosevelt who provided the funds to establish President Xi's alma mater, Tsinghua University.
Xi's toast was more stark, expressing a hope that the two countries can avoid conflict, avoiding the pattern of a rising power, like China, and an established one, like the U.S. His remarks were translated by an interpreter.
繁荣进步.
Today, President Trump and I had in-depth exchanges on China-U.S. relations and international and regional dynamics. We both believe that the China-U.S. relationship is the most important bilateral relationship in the world. We must make it work and never mess it up.
Talks will continue, with the U.S. likely pushing for trade deals, Taiwan probably hoping nothing more is said about U.S.-Taiwan arms sales, and China perhaps feeling like it is in the driver's seat. Reporting for Pacifica Radio News KPFA, I'm Christopher Martinez.
The leaders of the U.S. Navy and Marine Corps today testified before the House Armed Services Committee on the Trump administration's $377.5 billion budget request for the military branches. The funds would go towards building dozens of new ships and restocking munitions, among other things. KPFA's Max Pringle reports.
Acting Navy Secretary Hung Cao is a 25-year Navy veteran. He replaced former Navy Secretary John Phelan, who unexpectedly resigned his post last month. He testified to the need to bolster the Navy's capabilities at a time when the country is at war with Iran and faces threats around the world.
We have the obligation to give our sailors and Marines the very best equipment to do their jobs. In our historic budget of $377.5 billion, we're adding 34 new ships, varying from small to large combatants, 123 new aircrafts, along with 5 unmanned ships. In 5 years, we will add 122 manned and 63 unmanned ships. We are funding our readiness of our fleet to 95%.
Alabama Republican Mike Rogers chairs the House Armed Services Committee. He said the country is falling behind in shipbuilding, and President Trump's budget request will help ensure national security.
To maintain deterrence and ensure maritime dominance, we need a robust constellation of shipyards with modern infrastructure. It also demands a large, skilled workforce capable of meeting the increased demand for shipbuilding and repairing ships. The President's FY27 budget request of $1.5 trillion is crucial in reversing that decline.
But Democratic ranking member Adam Smith from Washington said the Navy and Marines can help defend the country with a more streamlined and efficient use of federal resources.
We have modern technology that can show us how to build the systems we need in a cheaper, more affordable way and put out a platform that enables us to achieve our objectives by taking advantage of having asymmetric advantages and figuring out what weapon systems we can have that can meet our needs. That's the way we need to be thinking. And we've discussed this, but all of what I've just said, the personification of the problem is the decision to go out and try to build a $22 billion battleship. I doubt seriously whether or not we can build that. I doubt even more seriously whether or not it is what we need at this point.
The Trump administration has proposed cutting up to $2 billion from the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration in its budget. NOAA researches the oceans and the weather. Democratic Congressman Eric Sorensen from Illinois asked Navy Secretary Hung Cao how that might affect a military force that operates on the ocean.
How important is it that we do focus on how our climate is changing?
Sir, we know always need, the climate's always changing. I mean, it's constantly changing. And again, that's why we need meteorologists to tell us where to go and when the best time to strike is.
The Navy's budget request is $70 billion more than its request last year. That represents a 23% increase. About $66 billion of that would go toward shipbuilding. For KPFA News, I'm Max Pringle.
The head of U.S. Border Patrol, Michael Banks, announced his resignation today amid ongoing leadership shakeups tied to the Trump administration's immigration crackdown. Banks, who confirmed his departure in an interview with Fox News, said it was, quote, just time, close quote, and claimed that he, quote, got the ship back on course, close quote, following what he described as chaos at the southern border. However, the resignation comes weeks after the Washington Examiner reported that 6 current and former Border Patrol employees accused Banks of repeatedly paying for sex with prostitutes during trips to Colombia and Thailand over more than a decade, and allegedly bragged to colleagues. One former Border Patrol agent told the Examiner, quote, I don't know how he became the chief of Border Patrol with his character. He's going to third world countries to take advantage of poor effing women, which disgusts the hell out of me, close quote. The anonymous source using the expletive. According to the report, the allegations were investigated twice by Customs and Border Protection officials, with one inquiry reportedly ending abruptly while former Homeland Security Secretary Kristi Noem was in office. Under Banks, Border Patrol expanded cooperation with ICE and took part in immigration enforcement operations in major U.S. cities, particularly Democratic-led cities, operations that have sparked controversy and protest nationwide. Banks previously served as border czar for Texas Governor Greg Abbott during the state's aggressive border enforcement campaign. Florida is expected to begin shutting down its controversial alligator Alcatraz migrant detention facility this summer. After months of legal challenges, criticism over conditions, and high operating costs. Vendors and contractors at the Everglades site were told detainees could be removed by early June, and the facility dismantled in the following weeks. The site has faced lawsuits and criticism from Democrats, immigrant advocates, and tribal groups over allegations of overcrowding, extreme heat, insect infestations, and limited attorney access. It had previously survived major legal challenges. An appellate court recently overturned a lower court order that would have forced Florida to shut it down and dismantle the camp, keeping it operational while litigation continued. Union nurses at California Nurses Association said they pressured Kaiser Permanente to delay the firing of a San Francisco nurse whose work authorization renewal under the Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals or DACA program had been delayed by the federal government. The nurse filed her DACA renewal application in December, 135 days before her status was set to expire on April 15th. Despite applying well within the recommended window, she did not hear back from the federal government before her status lapsed. At that point, Kaiser placed her on 30 days of unpaid leave. And in response to her inquiries, Kaiser wrote to her that it is, quote, your responsibility to keep your work authorization current, close quote. Earlier this week, the union held a protest in support of the nurse, accusing Kaiser of unfairly targeting her by placing her on unpaid leave and threatening termination. Union members said losing her job would have cost her her seniority, benefits, and position. Democratic Senator Alex Padilla of California said the case reflected a growing pattern under the Trump administration of DACA renewals being delayed past federal deadlines, with consequences beyond those directly affected.
When nurses and other care workers are pushed out because of the callousness of this administration, it's also their patients who suffer and the quality of care for all of us that suffers. It does not have to be this way. All DACA participants deserve better. Our country is better than this. It's long past time that Congress do the right thing and pass the DREAM Act once and for all.
The nurse at Kaiser San Francisco Medical Center was set to be fired today, but was notified that the termination deadline had been extended to June 15th, giving her more time to renew her DACA status. She also received notice that U.S. Citizenship and Immigration Services had finally approved her renewal application. The union said members of Congress, including Nancy Pelosi, Jamie Raskin, and Alex Padilla, contacted immigration officials on the nurse's behalf. The U.S. Supreme Court has preserved women's access to a drug used in the most common method of abortion, rejecting lower court restrictions while a lawsuit continues. The court's order Thursday allows women seeking abortions to continue obtaining the drug mifepristone at pharmacies or through the mail without an in-person visit to a doctor. Access is likely to remain uninterrupted at least until well into next year, as appeals play out in a suit filed by Louisiana, including a potential appeal to the high court. The court is dealing with its latest abortion controversy 4 years after its conservative majority overturned Roe v. Wade and allowed more than a dozen states to effectively ban abortion outright. Democrats on the House Oversight Committee are renewing calls for Commerce Secretary Howard Lutnick to resign following testimony about his past relationship with convicted pedophile Jeffrey Epstein. In a letter released today, Democratic lawmakers accused Lutnick of misleading Congress during a closed-door interview conducted earlier this month regarding his ties to Epstein. California Congressman Robert Garcia, the committee's ranking Democrat, said Lutnick spent, quote, his interview trying to cover up his lie and hide from the truth, close quote. Lawmakers pointed to previous public comments in which Lutnick claimed he cut ties with Epstein after visiting the financier's Manhattan home in 2005. However, Justice Department files released earlier this year reportedly show Lutnick later traveled to Epstein's private island in 2012, several years after Epstein served jail time for soliciting a minor for prostitution. Democrats say Lutnick failed to fully explain those visits during his testimony and accused him of lying and of lacking candor with Congress. The Commerce Secretary agreed to testify only after Democrats threatened to subpoena him. In their letter issued today, Oversight Democrats wrote that Lutnick's conduct demonstrates that he is unfit to serve as Commerce Secretary and called on him to step down immediately. The public comment period is now open on a Trump administration proposal to allow federally funded homeless shelters to deny transgender women access to women's bathrooms and sleeping quarters. Suzanne Potter reports.
Tony Newman with the nonprofit TransCan Work says the administration would replace the terms gender and gender identity with the word sex in the non-discrimination clause of the Equal Access Rule as it applies to shelters.
You know, this rule was really established to ensure that federally funded housing and shelter programs operate with fairness. No one really should be denied shelter or made to feel unwelcome, unsafe because of simply who they are.
The administration's proposed rule says the change is necessary to protect the safety of other people in the facility, and it allows shelter employees to ask questions or even require evidence to prove a person's sex at birth. However, the feds do not cite any evidence of harassment or harm done to shelter residents by transgender women staying in these areas. The 2022 U.S. Transgender Equality Survey found that 1 in 3 transgender people experience homelessness at some point, and 40% of the homeless youth population identifies as LGBTQ+. Mr. Trump tried to advance a similar rule during his first administration, but that proposal was rescinded under President Joe Biden. Newman says this type of discrimination violates transgender people's constitutional right to equal access.
Let's make it an equal playing field. Make it equal. And that's all I'm asking. Just fairness. Fairness to the poor.
People have until June 29th to put in their 2 cents on the Federal Register's website. For California News Service, I'm Suzanne Potter.
In election news, much of the focus on the ongoing redistricting wars in Virginia and Tennessee have been on which political party will come out on top in the race to control Congress. Critics of the Republican move to redraw congressional lines say the battle continues to be about disenfranchising black voters. Teresa Wersbianska has more.
House Democratic leader Hakeem Jeffries spoke on Capitol Hill this week and warned Republicans they would come to regret the congressional redistricting fight they started when the Supreme Court gutted the Voting Rights Act. Virginia officials are asking the U.S. Supreme Court to allow the state to move forward with a voter-approved redistricting plan that could give Democrats up to 4 additional seats in Congress. Virginia High Court rulings wiped out the Democratic gains in Virginia and threatened to erode black representation by Democrats in the Deep South. Here's Representative Hakeem Jeffries speaking on Capitol Hill.
Republicans have concluded that they need to cheat to win. That's what they're celebrating? Is that what you're elevating right now? The notion that 4 unelected judges would overturn the votes of more than 3 million citizens in Virginia? Is this what Republicans are celebrating right now? Because the people in Virginia right now are outraged, they're angry, and they're determined to send a message in November, regardless of what ultimately happens before the Supreme Court of the United States of America, where that reckless decision by the Virginia Supreme Court is now on appeal.
The shifting political landscape has been a challenge for Democrats, who so far are favored to win back the House this November. But this is also a test for Jeffries, who is in line to become House Speaker if the Democrats regain power. Republicans in the Commonwealth of Virginia are betting the redistricting plan will work out in their favor. Virginia House Minority Leader Terry Kilgore put the Democrats on blast in a statement to Fox Digital.
Because, I mean, it would be crazy to throw out judges for making the right decision. I mean, that would just be beyond the pale. I think a lot of Virginians would see through that. And, you know, it's too late for them to do it as a matter of law, because, you know, this Department of Election has to have this. Everything has to be done by the 12th of May. So we're already on that date. It's too late. But that just shows you how how power hungry Hakeem Jeffries and his Democrats are up there. And, I'm glad the Supreme Court followed the rule of law. And it was a good day for Virginia.
Over the last week, redistricting battles have rattled southern states after the Supreme Court gutted the Voting Rights Act. Tennessee House Democrats say they are being punished and silenced after House Speaker Cameron Sexton removed members of the caucus from standing committees following protests during a special session on congressional redistricting. Democrats had linked arms on the House floor to protest the new map that divides Memphis and could weaken representation in the state's only Democratic-held congressional district. Tennessee representative from Memphis, Justin Pearson, told supporters on his social media that this redistricting plan is intended to silence black voters.
And today, we received this letter from Cameron Sexton, who is also known as Ku Klux Cameron because of his persistence in perpetuating white supremacy in our state's capital by decisions like gutting the only majority black district in the state of Tennessee at the behest of Donald Trump and Governor Bill Lee. And now he's kicked every Democrat and every black Democrat off of their committee. This is anti-democratic. This is authoritarianism. This is what the abuse of power looks like in the South. And everybody needs to pay attention. This is not a game. This is silencing our voices where bills are being made that are going to impact the life of each and every one of the 7 million Tennesseans across this state. And he is upset that we stood up against his white supremacist actions of gutting the only majority black district of Memphis. Because we stood up in front of the well, because we spoke up, because we made sure our constituents' voices were heard, we all got kicked out of our committees where we represent the voices of our constituents. This is not normal. This is not okay. This is the deleterious effect of white supremacy in action and the destruction of the very pillars of democracy that so many people say that they believe in. This is a constitutional democratic republic, and this is how we lose it.
Lawmakers called the move unprecedented and retaliatory, arguing it effectively strips representation from about 1.5 million Tennesseans. Some analysts say the action may be legally permissible, but raises serious concerns about democratic process and whether voters who elected Democrats will still have a voice in legislative decisions. For Pacifica Radio, KPFA, I'm Teresa Wierzbianska.
Lawyers for Elon Musk and OpenAI delivered closing remarks today in a closely watched trial that could shape the future of the artificial intelligence industry. Musk, a co-founder of OpenAI, accuses the company and CEO Sam Altman of abandoning the nonprofit mission the organization was founded on in 2015 and shifting toward a for-profit business model without his knowledge. Musk invested roughly $38 million in OpenAI during its early years before leaving the company. The case comes as competition intensifies among major AI firms, including Musk's own company, xAI, and rival firm, Anthropic, which was founded by former OpenAI executives. All three companies are reportedly moving toward major public stock offerings. Jurors are being asked to decide whether Musk filed the lawsuit within the legal time limit. OpenAI argues Musk waited too long to bring the claims, which include breach of charitable trust and unjust enrichment. If jurors determine the case was filed on time, they must decide whether OpenAI violated its original nonprofit mission and whether executives, including Altman and OpenAI President Greg Brockman, improperly benefited from the company's transition. Microsoft, which is also named as a defendant, faces allegations that it aided in the alleged breach. Santa Clara County is suing Meta for alleged profits on scam advertisements. The civil suit, filed on Monday, accuses the tech giant of earning nearly $7 billion off advertisements the county claims showed clear signs of fraudulence. The lawsuit is led by Santa Clara County and is on behalf of all residents in California. The county seeks damages and stricter guardrails for Meta. KPFA intern Cade Young has more.
Santa Clara County's lawsuit alleges that Meta knowingly runs scam advertisements in violation of California's false advertising law. The lawsuit says that Meta runs an estimated 15 billion scam ads per day, and that Meta's internal review system correctly flags fraudulent ads, but instead of preventing them from airing on its platform, Meta charges premiums to allow those ads to bypass this internal checkpoint. Further, the lawsuit says that Meta amplifies these ads across their platforms and optimizes their reach. This has allegedly earned Meta nearly $7 billion in profit, with the downstream cost to vulnerable consumers being uncertain. Santa Clara County Council Tony Lopresti is leading the charge against Meta. He spoke out forcefully about the role Meta plays in scam advertisements on social media.
Meta is on the take. The complaint discusses internal documents showing that the company earns about $7 billion each year from scam ads alone. According to a recent investigation, even though Meta's internal warning systems might flag advertisements that are highly likely to be fraudulent, Meta allows those advertisements to post for a premium price. In other words, Meta has established a system for monetizing and profiting from fraud.
Lopresti also presented the county's case for the methodology Meta uses to profit on and amplify fraudulent ads.
What Meta is doing, one, is taking very deliberate measures to make sure that enough of those scam ads, many of those scam ads, get through. It's charging a premium price to scammers to actually post those ads when it knows that they might be highly likely to be scam ads. And then it's also using artificial intelligence and other tools to really make sure that those advertisements are reaching the broadest public audience.
In a statement provided to CBS News, Meta denied wrongdoing, saying, quote, "We aggressively fight scams on and off our platforms because they're not good for us or the people and businesses that rely on our services. We removed 159 million scam ads last year alone, launched new tools to protect people, and partnered with law enforcement around the globe to disrupt these criminals. We will fight this lawsuit," end quote. Lopresti challenged many of Meta's claims, noting that the county's lawsuit alleges Meta's scam ad rate is in the billions and that it accounts for nearly one-third of all scam advertisements online. Lopresti also challenged Meta's claims about fraud prevention and its efforts to combat fraudulent advertisements.
What Meta won't tell you is that in 2025, it prohibited its own fraud prevention teams from taking any action that could cost Meta more than 0.15% of the company's total revenue.
The suit will move forward with Santa Clara County seeking financial restitution for both consumers and legitimate advertisers whose own rates went up as they competed for ad space with scam advertisers. For KPFA News, I'm Cade Young.
This is the Pacifica Evening News, and I'm Lauren Schmidt. And right now we are in our spring membership drive. We try to fit in as much news as we absolutely could, because that's why you tune in every night at 6. But folks, we keep independent journalism like this on the air with your support. So we're asking you to call 800-439-5732. That's 800-HEY-KPFA or kpfa.org. I broke in at the middle of the broadcast to let you know that we have a $1,000 match from Kathy in Sonoma. Thank you, Kathy. And we are only $150 towards that match. We took a risk by not breaking in to do more pitching because we know you want to hear that news. And if you appreciate what you heard tonight, please become a member. Go to kpfa.org and pledge your support, or you can call 800-439-5732. Independent journalism is worth supporting, and it survives because ordinary people like you decide it's worth protecting. And it matters because corporate media too often overlooks stories affecting working class communities, immigrants, 2S, LGBTQIA+, and marginalized folks around the world. You know, we've heard a lot in the U.S. media about the economic toll being forced upon citizens. here in the United States because of a war of choice, but we rarely hear about how others are impacted. And while we're working to find more voices on the ground in Iran, I felt it was really important tonight to hear from people in Lebanon. Voices I found extremely relatable. And that reminds me of what Amy Goodman had previously said. She says she sees media as a huge kitchen table that stretches across the globe. And that really resonates with me, because if you tune in to our Pacifica Evening newscast, we truly place an emphasis on international news and its intersections with national and local news. And I am so proud of the work this mighty but small newsroom is able to accomplish day in and day out on a truly shoestring budget. But that is our scrappy grassroots nature. And here at KPFA, we make the decision every day to continue covering those stories because we believe listeners deserve reporting with context, humanity, and accountability. Unlike other outlets that sell advertisers your attention, we are only accountable to you because we only take donations from our listeners. It's truly a wild concept that shocks people when I tell them, but we have been doing this for nearly 80 years because our founders saw the writing on the wall over 7 decades ago. Yet I'm sure they could have never imagined today's media hellscape. But here, KPFA, the Pacifica Evening News, we exist to resist that, and it requires your support, your participation. You do not have to be a billionaire to own a media outlet. You can be you and meet us where you are at, contributing any amount, whether that's $5 or $500. That makes you a member, makes you one of our most important stakeholders in upholding truth and equity in our reporting. I'm asking you, buy stock in our independent journalism by going to kpfa.org or by calling 800-439-5732. No callers on the line. Will you be the first? Help us meet this goal. We have about 4 minutes left to the end of this broadcast. Vote with your dollars. Support the Pacifica Evening News. And I'm currently joined by KPFA's Development Director, Laura Privis.
Yeah, folks, and we really need you to step up right now. We did try to bring you as much of the newscast as we possibly could, but now we have a $1,000 match on the line and we need people to help us to make this. I think Lauren's point is true. We're asking for you to invest in ethical independent media. And that's what we are. And it's not, we can see what has happened in this world when commercial entities are the ones who own the newsroom. You get a very different outcome. So if you're tuning in, you're tuning in for a reason. You rely on what we're doing here, and you understand that you can trust it. And that's what we're asking for you to pay for. I have a friend who's a journalist. She's like, yeah, you really do need to pay for your news these days if you want to really trust it. And also the added bonus, when you're donating to KPFA, you're not just supporting it for yourself. It's not your own private stream. You're supporting it for the whole community, for people who can't or who don't even know about it so that they can run across it. So please go to kpfa.org or 1-800-439-5732. Also in the Los Angeles area, go to kpfk.org or 818-985-5735 extension 2, and help us here to make this match and also to reach our $450,000 goal. Every hour needs to count. That's why we do these matches, because we need to incentivize you to give right now, because if every hour doesn't work, the whole thing doesn't work. We really need to make this amount of money to help us to pay our bills for the next several months. KPFA.org or KPFK.org. Lauren?
Absolutely, because of Sandra in Petaluma, who says, thank you for the caring and hard work that goes into this show. Your integrity is so refreshing. I couldn't agree more. Anonymous in Woodside, Scott in Petaluma, and Anonymous in Santa Cruz. We are about halfway to that goal with two callers on the line. Folks, we are asking you to buy stock in independent journalism by going to KPFA.org or by calling 800-439-5.
Coming up this week on LA Theater Works.
Claudia's pregnant. How should she give birth? She gets advice from her friends and internet message boards, but her car mechanic dad might have the best answer of all.
Every 10 seconds without oxygen, the baby...
Baby's out!
Oopla! You